Hi, everybody. In case you haven't noticed, I was handing around the course evaluation forms. So if you didn't get one, wave. So we'll send one your way. I was thinking that during the quicker questions, I know some people have a little bit of downtime while you're waiting for everybody else to finish up. So if you can just hold on to these and work on them until we're done with the quicker questions, and then we'll try to collect them up. Seems like that's a more efficient use of time. I think I'm supposed to just like leave and let you do this, but my eyesight's not very good anyway, so I'm not looking. I claim. All right. Apart from that, any other announcements? I am almost halfway done creating the sample final, so I should have that out before the end of the week. I would highly encourage everybody to go through it and make sure that you understand the kinds of questions that I'm putting on there. I'm making the sample final and the final exactly parallel with each other at the same time. So if you look at the sample final, and not just look at it, if you go through and work all the problems and make sure you really understand them, then the final will be a breeze, and that's 40% of your grade. So that will be no problem at all. But if you don't, then you will be very surprised when the final comes. And you say, but he never told us how to do that. And I will say, I kind of did, but then you didn't ask me about it. Anyway, it'll be fine. Just look at the sample final, please. And that should be out soon. There have been some problems with the clicker grades, but we're getting that taken care of. Ari's completely on the case. He says there's no bug, but if there is a bug, then he's going to give me a Mountain Dew. Is that right?
Yeah, I assert I'm the best programmer ever.
Ari says he's the best programmer ever, so you should all be very pleased to have shared a room with him. But we'll find out. Right. This is an empirical question. And if it turns out that he's wrong, then, you know, we'll flay him. Because why not? All right. Any other questions? I think anything that you need to fill out the teaching evaluation is up there. Oh, there is one thing that I wanted to tell you. We're not doing content for a moment. I wish I had actually thought about it ahead of time, though. I'll just give you the background, and I'm not sure I can tell you much more than that. But the gentleman who is in charge, the vice president of Rutgers in charge of research, is a guy named Michael Pisani. And one of the things that's interesting about him, in particular to me, is because when they hired him, it turns out he was, before he was an administrator, he was a computer scientist. And he's, I presume, still a computer scientist. And in fact, within computer science, his area is artificial intelligence, like mine. And within artificial intelligence, his area is machine learning, like mine. So he's like a big guy in my little subfield of the universe, and he happens to be now in charge of the research efforts at all of Rutgers. He says that undergraduates have an incomplete view of what research professors do for a living. Like, what is it that people like me do here at the university? And he said specifically what I should tell you that we do, and that's the part that I'm having trouble remembering. I mean, I can tell you what I do. I know actually what I do. I spend a lot of time doing it. In fact, I spend all my time doing what I do, by definition. But the point is, no, I completely lost the point. What do I want to tell you? So I think a lot of college students, maybe you, maybe not you, think of professors as like high school teachers, who do a very important thing, but they teach a lot more than people like me do. High school teachers teach almost the whole day, plus they do curriculum development and any kind of extracurriculars and stuff that they're involved in, but their main thing is teaching. People like me, my main thing is not actually teaching. Mainly what I'm here to do is to do research, generate papers, guide students like Ari and Monica, actually work in my lab, to become scientists and go out in the world and contribute in various ways. I have to then shoehorn into that full schedule teaching. And so he said that some of the students that he talked to think that faculty spend maybe, you know, like 80 or 90 hours a week in front of a class teaching. And really, it's, you guys see me all the time. That's all the lecture teaching I do. I don't have any other classes that I teach that way. I have a seminar, graduate seminar that I run, and I talk to my students in that setting, but it's much more informal, casual setting, not really preparation. It's mostly, again, getting people to learn how to think like scientists. And apart from that, it's mostly working one-on-one with my students, writing papers. I do a lot of reviewing of papers that are going to be published in journals and conferences and so forth. And, you know, it fills up my day. But I don't know if you find that useful or not. Oh, the other thing he said that, people might find interesting is that if you go on to graduate school in many areas, many research areas, they pay you to do that. Especially for computer science, for example. We pay Ari to be our friend, to be here and working with us. He doesn't have to pay for his PhD education. It can be a long time and take a lot of years, but you're actually being paid while it's happening. He said a lot of the undergrads that he talked to didn't have had no absolutely no idea of how that went. It's different than, say, med school. They don't pay you to go to med school. But often, they will pay you to go to graduate school, certainly in computer science and chemistry and math. Yeah, certainly the sciences. I don't know the humanities as well, but I assume that a lot of those students are supported as teaching assistants. So now you know. All right. The reason that it made me think of telling you this story right now is that these teaching evaluations that you do, some people use them as an excuse to vent, which I can understand, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to want to do. They are actually taken quite seriously, however. Just so that you know this, when you fill out these teaching evaluations, they're actually used in deciding whether or not to promote people, deciding whether or not to give people raises, people, you know, like me, people, and whether or not to give them tenure or fire them. So it really ends up having an impact. And it's one of these interesting things where they measure what our paper output is and what our impacts on the community are, but the only measure of teaching effectiveness that's used at a place like Rutgers is what you guys say on these evaluations. So I just feel like you should feel empowered in that sense, right? You are definitely being listened to. And so if you're really pissed off at somebody, it can have an impact on that person's life. If, on the other hand, you feel, you know, say, somewhat positively towards someone who maybe is sharing information with you, then you can give them a high teaching evaluation, and that also has a positive impact, just so you know. Okay. Any questions about that? I'm not just kissing up. I'm kissing up and giving you information. All right. Okay, with that said, what I'd like to do is go into a couple quicker questions to reinforce the topic that we ended up with last time, which was on compression, and to also to reinforce a new kind of question that I'm putting on the exam that sort of came up in a previous quicker question, just to make sure that you have to expose you to it as much as I can. All right. Oh, this is the thing that occurred to me yesterday. So it turns out that Hanukkah started last night, which took my spouse and I by surprise, because somehow we thought it started today. The Jewish holidays, when they say what day it starts on, it actually is the night before. And so if you see, oh, it says Hanukkah starts Wednesday, you think, oh, Wednesday night. But actually, it's Tuesday night. So we scrambled to get prepared. But here's the thing that you notice. If Hanukkah lasted for N nights, how many candles would you light? So here's how Hanukkah works in terms of the candles. First night of Hanukkah, you light one candle, and then it burns down. The second night of Hanukkah, you light two candles, and then they burn down. Third night of Hanukkah, you light three candles, and then they burn down. On the nth night of Hanukkah, you light N candles, and if N is big enough, you start a fire. But then on the next, anyway, it just keeps growing like that. So each day, you light the number of candles equal to the day. And this is true. And Hanukkah candles come in boxes specifically of the right number so that you can get by with this. N is 8, in case you didn't know that for Hanukkah. But it could be N, it could be any number. So how does the number of candles grow as the number of nights of Hanukkah grows?
Wait, you said one.
You'd be like one candle the first night, two candles the second night, three candles the third night. So the first, second, and third nights all together is 1 plus 2 plus 3, or 6. So 3 nights is 6 candles. And it goes on. For the 8 nights, it's like the boxes are like 144 candles, because you also include the shop. Right?
Yeah, so it's like an extra one.
For yeah, so every night there's also an extra one. All right. You know, it's not every holiday where you feel like, hey, wait, I could say something about asymptotic growth.
It's awesome.
And to admit that you completely forgot, like, your children's favorite holiday. Anybody need a couple more seconds? All right, 3, 2, 1, stopping. All right, so we've seen this pattern again and again and again, and it always has the same answer. So what we're talking about is really, like on the nth night of Hanukkah, you're lighting N candles. there's N nights altogether, and you're lighting, you know, sort of N-ish candles on each night. So it's N, it's essentially N times N, or N squared. But you can also think of it this 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4. So by the end night of Hanukkah, you're lighting this many candles altogether, which is like N squared. It's actually what? N times N plus 1 over 2, which is N squared. So, okay.
Good. Did that work for everybody?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Any questions? There's no logs in Hanukkah. There's logs in Christmas, though, right?
Is logs in Kwanzaa?
There's logs, like lighting logs? Those kind of logs? No.
Yeah, Kanara. It's like...
Oh. All right. But it's not like in log in, probably. Different kind of log. All right. Or Yule log is what I was thinking of. All right. So we stepped through the compression process last time. So just, you need a piece of paper, and it takes a minute or two to work it through, but make sure... I thought it would be helpful to just record one more of these before you see it on the final. The question on the final looks exactly like this, except it doesn't give you the choices. So you do want to know how that works. I need a piece of paper. If anybody has come late and wants to fill out a teaching evaluation or course evaluation form, let me know. I'll send one your way. Does it need to be pencil or pen?
Okay,
I got a pen for you. Just, can I have it back in? Yeah, it doesn't matter, but yeah, zero left, right one. It shouldn't change the answer, but yeah, get in the habit of that. Yeah, zero, one. I'm not allowed to see that. Oh, the pen I wasn't allowed to see.
We're not doing anything else. Hand in this sort of direction.
Each letter appears. M, I, S, S, I, S, S, I, P, P, I. All right, so we've got two M's, four I's, four S's, and two P's.
One
M. Thank you. All right, now we start building a tree. We always take the two smallest things that we've got and merge them together. At the moment, we've got a one and a two. So we make a tree that at the bottom has the one M and the two P's. We merge together and we get three. Okay? Now we've got three things left. We've got four I's, four S's, and three of these things, MPs, together. So we want to merge this with one of the fours. It doesn't matter which one in terms of the final answer, but you do get a different tree. I'm going to merge my I in. So now we've got four S's and seven MPIs. So we'll merge the S in, four S's, for a total of 11. Now our code, we've got 000 for M, 001 for P, 01 for I, and just one all by itself for S. So Mississippi's got one M, so there's three bits on the M's. It's got two P's, each one is three bits. So this one's three bits and this is three bits for a total of six. We've got four I's, each one is two bits long, so that when we write out Mississippi, eight of the bits is going to be for the I's. And we've got four S's, each one is one bit long, so that's going to take up four bits. What do we get? Six plus four is 10, plus these guys is 21. Or E. Which was a little bit ahead of the others, but if you look, it looks pretty flat across the edge. So, anything else I can tell you to clarify?
Is that the only way you can draw that tree?
No. There's different trees you can get. They will all give the same final answer. But you can always flip zeros and ones. It doesn't change anything. And in this case, we had to merge the M and the P first. There was no other way to do it. But then once we had this group of three, we could have merged it with I or S. At that point, because I and S were both fours. So we needed a three and a four together, but it didn't matter which one. So I did I, but you could have done S. You could have merged it in on the left. It would have looked different, but it would have given the same total.
Could you have, leave I and S in order
to make that, and then merge those together? All right, so that's a good question. That was what I saw you do as well. So I think the question is, can we do this? So at this point, we've merged the M and the P together. Now we've got I, S, and the MP group. Can you merge these guys together? And the answer is, well, you can, but you get the wrong answer. The reason you get the wrong answer is because these fours, both, we want to merge the two smallest things together, and three is smaller than four. So if you merge the two fours together, let's watch what happens. We can still get a code, but it won't be the shortest possible code. So we merge those two guys together. We get an 8 group and a 3 group. We merge those together. We get an 11 group. Now, M is 2 bits long for a total of 2 bits on the M. P is 2 bits long. There's 2 of them, so that's 4. I is 2 bits long, and there's 8 of those, so that's 8. Sorry, there's 4 of those, so that's 8. And S is 2 bits long, and there's 4 of them, so that's another 8. So let's see what total we get. We get 10 and 8 and 12, which is 22. So you get a code, but notice it's 1 bit longer. It's not as compressed. And the reason it wasn't as compressed is because we didn't merge the smallest possible things together first. By merging the smallest things together, you end up assigning the short codes to the short codes to the letters that appear most often, and long codes to the ones that are less common. Does that help?
Cool.
Yes.
Would you be the area where the sequence of zeros and ones?
Oh, sure, no problem. All right. So, and note it on the final, the question is going to look like this, except without the multiple choice. Well, there's going to be two kinds of questions. One is going to just say, what's the total number of bits? In which case, the code doesn't really matter. On another one, I'm going to give you a tree like this and ask you what the codes are. And I'll label them like this. I'll put a 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1. So here's how you get the code for this tree. You start at the root, and you follow the branches. There's a 1 branch and a 0 branch. A right branch and a left branch. So that's 1, 0. Right? It's basically like giving instructions to drive someplace. Start at the root. Where should I go? If I'm trying to get to S, where should I go? I should go down a right branch, that's a 1, and then another right branch, that's a 1.
And that's 2 bits?
And it's 2 bits, yeah, in this case. If the tree were lopsided, then it might be longer than that. Right. So if the tree looked like this, then S is just 1 by itself, it's 1 bit. But I is 0, 1, left, right, 2 bits. Good? All right, good? PG.
What would this be used for?
So computers do something like, they never do it on words, individual words like Mississippi. They take huge files like, the entire dictionary or like all the email messages that you've got on your computer or whatever, and they try to find a way of expressing that information in as few bits as possible. So this lets you take a file and compress it so that it takes up less space on your disk or less time to transmit. Right? Notice that it matters, right? So in the case where we merged the fours together first, we ended up with a bit code for Mississippi that was 22 bits long, but when you did it the right way, it was only 21 bits long. Now, 1 bit isn't going to make that much difference, but if you have a file which consists of Mississippi repeated a billion times, then that would be a lot more bits that you save.
So is the tree transmitted along the...
That's a very good question. I think that is the case, in fact, yes. Like, if I have a very, very long document, and, it's Moby Dick or something like that. I want to send you Moby Dick in as few bits as possible. What I can do is I can take, find the letter frequencies, build the Huffman code tree. Then what I need to do is send you the tree in bits. Then I send you Moby Dick using that code. And that will be a lot less than if I just sent Moby Dick straight out with a longer code. So, yes, that's right. So there's two, yeah, that's exactly right. And you need to send the tree too, which of course makes no sense if I'm just sending you the word Mississippi, because the tree is as big as the word, pretty much. But again, you have to think much bigger, much, much bigger. Like all the web pages and records, that sort of thing. Now the tree is this tiny little insignificant piece. Okay? All right. So the next thing I think I'm not going to ask as an actual question, but I'm just going to tell you the answer. So, which of these functions grows fastest? Which of these blows up the most, gets big fastest? So, the more, so n is just n by itself. Log n is log n by itself. C is n times log n, so it's the product of those two. So that grows faster than both log n and n. So n log n grows faster, bigger than log n or n. N squared is n times n, so that grows bigger than n. It turns out that n is bigger than log n, so n squared is also bigger than n log n. So D is bigger than C. And then the biggest one is this last one, N times N times log N. So that one grows the fastest. That would be E.
I hadn't been very explicit about this in the past. I was saying, hey, we want to prefer quick sort, which is N log N, to selection sort, which is N squared. Why? Oh, because N squared is actually, it grows much faster. This is much slower running time than this one. But I never actually said that in words. Yeah.
What's the behavior for log N again, N log N?
Like, when do you get these sorts of things popping up?
Yeah, what's the, like...
Oh, what do the curves look like? Right, N is just, you know...
Straight up.
Yeah, now it looks like I'm saluting. That's not good. Log N looks a lot like square root. It curves down a bunch more.
Curves and evens out?
It doesn't exactly even out. It's always growing.
Oh, okay.
It just grows really, really slowly. Yeah. N log N is like the product of those two. It looks
like N, basically.
It looks a lot like N. Yeah, it's N with a tiny little bit of, you know, yeah, just, and once you go out far enough, you can't even see it anymore. Just in the beginning, you can see it's got a little bit extra curve. N squared is a quadratic. It's the parabola shape.
Yeah, I know that. What's
N squared log N is, again, it's a parabola times something that's essentially a constant. So
steeper, or?
It looks a little bit steeper than the N squared.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if you're drawing. Okay, so that's the largest. Which one grows the most slowly? That would be log N. Log N grows really slowly. There are things that grow even more slowly. All right, but so this is a question that I wanted to be able to ask. And I talked about this last time in class, but I think we can solve these sorts of things. So let's find out. So you have a list of integers of length n. How fast can you answer the following questions if the list is unsorted versus sorted? Your choices are, it's always going to be O of 1, O of log n, O of n, of O of n squared. So the question that we want an algorithm to answer is, does the smallest number in the list appear twice? Okay, so you have a big, long list of numbers, and the question is, how long does it take you to answer that question if the list is sorted or if the list is unsorted? In this case, it looks like if you can just answer either of them, it tells you which your choice is. Because I didn't really mix and match very much. Unless you think the first one's log n. So how would we do this? We have this long list of numbers, and it's not sorted. Let's first think about not sorted. How do we find out if the smallest number in the list appears twice? Does it say exactly twice? Whatever. At least twice. Twice. So how can we do that? Well, I don't know. What would you do if I gave you this huge pile of numbers? You'd have to...
sort them?
Well, you could sort them, but you don't have to quite sort them.
Process of sorting and put store the smallest number while you're, and then if you come across it again, you know.
Sure. And so how long does that take?
Log n if you do quick sort.
No, quick sort is n log n.
Oh.
Which isn't one of the choices. But it's kind of like n squared. But in general, so how do you find the smallest one? To find the smallest one, you have to go through, just scan through the list. Just go, is this the smallest? Is this the smallest? And while you're doing that, you can also keep track of, oh, here it is again. Right? You can just keep track of that one scan through the list, which is O of n. That's what O of n is. It's just one loop through the list. Okay? So the first, so if it's unsorted, it's O of n. But what if it's sorted? How do you actually figure out the answer to this question? You have a sorted list, and you want to know, is the smallest one in this list appearing at least twice? How can you check that? So you'd look. Where would you look?
Is it largest or smallest?
Yeah, smallest to largest.
The smallest.
So we go to the small end, and we look to see what the smallest one is. And then what do? We have to then look through the whole list to see if we see it again?
No.
What do? You look in the second. You look in the first position and say, oh, here's the smallest number. And then you look in the second position and say, is it the same? And that, so that's O of 1. That's constant. We only have to look at just those two places and we're done. We don't need log n. We don't need n squared, anything like that. So the answer should be C. I can do that. Any questions on those? So on the sample final, I'm going to give you a couple of these. And on the final, the questions look a lot like them. So if you can't quite figure out what's going on, pattern matching will get you most of the way there. And you're allowed to have the all your notes you can bring to the final. Just bring the right notes. All right, any other questions on that? Are we ready to, I've got a demo about parallel processing, and then we're gonna get into, what's the next one? Learning in robots. All right? So, all right, so. Oh, chapter 7 is in here. Yeah. All right, so we're talking about parallel processing. The idea of parallel processing is instead of just having one computer doing all the work, we can actually have maybe a bunch of computers, each working on a different part of the problem. And there's lots of things in the real world where people have used this idea to great benefit. So one of them is computer graphics. So when you look at a movie like Shrek, or even like Beowulf, even some of these live action movies where they're putting in tons and tons of computer graphics on top, what's happening there is they have to get the computers to draw all the dots on all the frames of the movie, which is a very time-consuming process. So what they do is they actually get lots and lots of computers at Pixar and all these big special effects houses. They've got racks and racks and racks of computers, really fast computers. And what they do is they break up the problem of making the picture into pieces, and then they have each computer work on a piece of that. And so if they break it up finely enough, 10 computers can get the work done 10 times as fast. Weather modeling is a very similar kind of idea. Very independent computations like mailing out phone bills or processing a bunch of parallel customers. I want to give you one concrete example that's like this that I think is really easy to think about. And this is the idea of, let's say we're going to make an image. We're going to make a picture. Picture's made up of individual little pixels. So let's say that the computation that decides what color each pixel is can be done independently of all the other pixels. So all we need to do is assign each pixel to a computer, or maybe a small group of pixels to a computer. It can do its work, and then we can display the whole thing. So what would that look like? What's a sort of example where we can do that? So let's say each color of a pixel is specified by three numbers. How much red is in it, how much blue is in it, how much green is in it. And those are numbers, integers, between 0 and 255, at least on my computer. So what we're going to do is for each pixel, we're going to have a little program that decides what color should that pixel be. And so this decision is essentially being made for all the pixels in parallel, and then we get to see the result. So here's a lovely lavender-like color. It turns out that the color of this box is, it's got 161 units of red in it, 129 of green, and 226 of blue. And if you set the pixel values to that, that's the color that you get. So here's a program, a parallel program, that does this. That. All right. So let me break this down, try to get you to understand it piece by piece. So ignore the middle part for the moment, even though that's where the fun is. We've got to start with the big picture. So here's what's happening. In this light blue box,
is a program that's going to run on every single pixel in the image simultaneously. Here is the output of that program. So if you look at what the program says, is that the amount of red out, can you see where it says that? Red out is 161, green out is 129, and blue out is 226. So every pixel is setting its red, green, and blue to the combination that makes lavender. And so what we get is a whole array of lavender pixels, a nice purplish rectangle. All right? Is that an okay name for that color? You okay with that? Do you have a better name for that? I find that, you know, when I go out with my spouse and so forth, I say, oh, what a lovely white. And she says, no, it's eggshell. So, I mean, I think this is lavender. All right, go with it. With what you've learned so far, we can set the red, the green, and the blue to be any number we want, and we can get different colors that way. So we can play this game. Let's play this game. Here we go. Here's the program. This is the actual live program. At the moment, I have it set so that the red value is set to 0, the green value is set to 0, and the blue value is set to 0, and that makes black. But we can change it to something else. If we change the green value to, say, 256, and then we say, you know, run, now this little program is now running on all the pixels, and what do we get? We get green. Why? Because that's the color you get when there's no red or blue, but there's lots of green. You with me? If you're interested, give me some other numbers, and I can put them in there for you. You can try it out.
What if they're all equal?
What if they're all equal? Well, equal to what?
Doesn't matter.
I don't think that's a number.
256.
Oh, okay, sorry, 256 is not okay. It's actually 255 is the biggest number. Let's set them all to 100. Okay. All right, we set them all to 100, and we combine, we get that. What would you call that?
Gray.
If we set it,
yeah. Would it be the same if you set them all to like 200, same color?
Let's find out. I'll do 255. Oops. Interesting. Sorry. I failed to type the other zeros, and we got some kind of a mustard, perhaps? All right. When all three values are the same, set to the same number, you get a gray. And the brightness of the gray, if the numbers are close to 255, it's white. If they're close to 0, it's black. And in between, you get all the different shades of gray. So you get 256 levels of gray from white to black. All right, so this is all very fun and good, and we can make any color we want this way, or at least 256 times 256 times 256 possible colors. But that's not all that interesting. Let's kind of move on from there and see what happens next. So that's the way this program works. What about this? All right, so in addition to having the numbers, we also have three other values. Red 1, green 1, and blue 1 are... So think of it this way. Each of the image is here in front of us, and each pixel in the image has its own little computer running on it that runs this program to decide what color to be, but it has access to the corresponding pixel of image 1. Image 1 was the picture of, well, in the slides, it's, do you know what that is? What's that building? That's ARC, the Allison Road Classroom Building, but I changed it for this year. Do you recognize that building? That's ARC. That's where we are right now. All right. So this is an image. Each pixel in this image has some red, blue, and green value. So each processor, each little computer now has access to, it can output the color of the output image, but it has as input available to it the corresponding pixel in image 1 and also in image 2. Does anybody know what this is? Stephen Colbert. What is he doing? He's got a lightsaber. He's pretending to be a Jedi. And he's against a green screen. People are familiar with what are green screens for?
Special effects.
Yeah, for what? Yeah, so what you can do... Yeah, go ahead.
It's like you use computer projective on a person.
Yeah. So you can take one image and fill it in wherever there's green in another image. Okay? So that's what we're gonna work up to that. But for now, each pixel has accessible to it the red, green, and blue from the first image at that position, and the red, green, and blue in the Colbert image at that same position. Okay? So, for example, we can say something like this. Set the output red value
to be whatever the red input red value is in image 1, the green value to be whatever the green is in image 1, and the blue to be whatever the blue is in image 1. And now our output image is image 1, right? Because at each position, it's matching exactly image 1. So altogether, it becomes image 1. All right? Does that make sense? More or less? All right? So, but we can go there. We can be really weird, right? Now we can say things like, we're going to set the red to be 0 for every pixel in this image, blue to be 0, but we're going to set green to be whatever the green is in the source image. All right? So now what we've done is we've taken all the pixels of this image and one by one squelched out their blue and red and only left what was green in it. And so what you get is an image that's actually kind of creepy green. Maybe not creepy, but it's green. And you'll see that the things that are green in the original image look more or less the same, but things that are a mixture of green and other things now look very strange. They look just bright green.
Night.
What's that?
Night vision.
Is that what night vision looks like? Yeah, I guess so. So now what if we do this? Who can guess what this will look like? We're setting the amount of red in this image to be however much green is there. We're setting the green to be however much green is there. And we're setting the blue to be however much green is there. All three values are now what?
Equal
to each other, right? And what do we say when three values are equal to each other? What color do we get? We get gray. But we're going to get a darker or lighter gray depending on how much green is at that same pixel position in the other image. So, what do we get? We get something that looks kind of like black and white or grayscale, right? You see it? Like the color's gone because the red, green, and blue in the image are all equal at all pixels. But they get brighter or less bright depending on the original image. So you really see that kind of effect. We can get a slightly better answer if you do this. We're going to make a new variable called average, and we're going to set it to typing and talking at the same time. So at each pixel, it's going to take the amount of red, green, and blue in that image and just average them together to get an overall kind of brightness. And then it's going to assign that value to the red, green, and blue outputs. So it should look mostly the same as what we saw, but it's kind of a better black and white. Let's see. Yeah, so you see that the red statue was a little bit too dark before, and now it looks more in line with the original image. All right? Any brainstorms about other things to try with this? I'm going to keep elaborating on it, but I wanted to give you a chance to intercede. Because this is, it's all live. We can try whatever we want. Or not. Okay, moving on. You didn't even ask me the best thing we could do. We can very easily at this point do this. Right? So now we're taking the red, green, and blue from the second image and using that to set the pixel value. So now what we should get... So it looks like the recorder ran out of batteries, or at least got low on batteries around now. The rest of the discussion of lecture 6, I think, was on the problem of working up to a green screen program, which is in the lecture notes, so you can see it there. Then I started up into the robotics lecture and machine learning lecture, and basically I went through the slides actually fairly quickly because I wanted to try to get up to the robot demo, which I wasn't able to complete, but I will try to complete in the next lecture. Oh, and by the way, I'm very curious as to whether anyone actually listens to these podcasts, so the first person who hears this message and sends me email gets 5 points extra credit on the final. Thanks. Just send me mail. So after about 30 minutes elapsed, I did realize that the recorder had switched off, and I switched it back on and was able to get the remainder of the lecture. So we're picking up from, maybe about halfway into the robotics lecture. One last thing. The person whose name I'm about to forget is Robin Murphy. And that's Robin, I forgot her last name. She's a professor in Florida. She sends robots into disaster sites. These are remote-controlled robots, so there's people activating them. But, she was on scene when the World Trade Center was destroyed.
not at the time, but shortly after, sending her robot in looking for survivors and stuff. So I heard her give a talk once. It was the only time I've ever actually cried at a scientific talk. It was really heavy, important stuff. And this is all enabled by the fact that she has these robots that actually go into the world and do important things. So, but here's something that's not so important, but I want to show you anyway, which is, this is the Sony Aibo. This is, it's, you know, fairly full functional computer, but it's got legs and a head and a camera on the end of its nose, just like a real dog. It's got an LED on its tail. It's got a wireless card in its wazoo, batteries and so forth. And so this is actually a pretty neat piece of hardware. The folks at Sony did a terrific job with it. It has a speaker on the roof of its mouth so it can make noise. It's got little LEDs so it can flash on its face. And it's got a jaw that can open and close for no good reason. Other than it just looks adorable. So this is like the cutest robot around. So the next thing I was going to talk about in the lecture, which I'm not going to get to until next time, is some of the ways that we use these kinds of robots in our research, in our lab. But I just wanted to show you the robot doing its thing, in case you hadn't seen it before, because they're just awesome. So this is, it's booting up. It's a computer. It's just booting up. This is like the equivalent of the Windows. So you can see the little LEDs going on the face and so forth. I wanted to find the learning program, and maybe I'll have it by next time. But this is just a little demo that's just built into it. And so what's happening in there is a little computer that's just sending signals to all the motors, telling them when to move and how far and how fast. And when you write programs for these things, you just coordinate that. You coordinate all those motions to do the sorts of things that you're seeing. So, you know, you turn this and you cock the ear a little bit, and it like that, and it looks curious. It's actually not emotionally curious at the moment. It's just showing off for us. But nevertheless, it enables all sorts of things. If you move the legs in a particular pattern, the thing walks, right? That's what is walking. Walking is sending the right signals to the right parts of the peripherals, the motors, at the right time. The sounds are just gratuitous. They're just beeping and so forth. It does have stereo microphones on its cheeks, on the two sides there. And so you can actually write a program that listens how loud are things on this side versus this side. And you can program it to, whenever it hears things louder on one side than the other, to turn a little bit in the direction that was louder. And so and walk a little bit. So what you can do is actually train them to come. Not so much train them, you can program them to come by having it run that program, and then you clap over here, it's louder on this side than that side, so it turns, and it'll keep turning until it's equal on both sides. And then it'll walk towards you. And so I've actually seen that demo done. Robots basically learning how to come to the right position using their auditory sensors. The camera is also really useful. It can see things. So, I don't know, pretty cool. So I'll try to get the other part of the demo set up for next time. But in case I forget, this is the Aibo. You can come take a look at it if you want. This one, by the way, is wearing a soccer uniform. We actually competed one year in a national robot soccer competition. And they all had to wear either blue uniforms or red uniforms. They're just stickers. So we had to actually, at halftime, like switch all the stickers from red to blue. And they had to work together as a team and shoot the ball. It was adorable. It's the only time I've enjoyed watching soccer. If you haven't done the student evaluations, please do, or the course evaluations, and then hand them to Anjali this way. And we can all, you know, thank you, Anjali, for taking care of this for all of us. Or me, as it were. I don't know.